Coming up on this week's book show, Jenny Offill's new novel, Weather, is about a family and a nation in crisis. Lizzie Benson slid into her job as a librarian without a traditional degree, but this gives her a vantage point from which to practice her other calling. She is a fake shrink, which sees her advice grow increasingly apocalyptic and unhinged. Jenny Offill on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Jenny Offill's new novel, Weather, is about a family and a nation in crisis. Lizzie Benson slid into her job as a librarian without a traditional degree, but this gives her a vantage point from which to practice her other calling. She is a fake shrink. As Lizzie dives into this polarized world, she begins to wonder what it means to keep tending your own garden once you've seen the flames beyond its walls. Jenny Offill is the author of the novels Last Things, a New York Times Notable Book of the Year, as well as Department of Speculation, which was shortlisted for the Folio Prize, the Pen Faulkner Award, and the International Dublin Award. Again, the new book is Weather, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the book show this week. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I love this novel because it is a novel, and I hope that this comes as a compliment to you. I think it will. I'm not positive, but I think it will. Which is that people say, oh, I've read the book 2, 3, 4 times. But I did that while I was reading it. In the sense of you read a passage and then you want to go back and read it again a few times so that you understand and kind of marvel in the beauty of the language.
Oh, well, thank you. I'll certainly take that as a compliment. When you're writing, you hope that you're putting in some layers to it so that it goes, you can go back to it.
How do you describe the style of the novel? I see it as short bursts that mm-hmm. come out in the 6 parts of the novel. How do you describe it?
Well, when I was first thinking of this novel, I kept thinking about the word atmospheric and how it's used in blurbs and things like that. And I did sort of want this novel to be literally atmospheric, and I wanted it to kind of be something that would swirl around or eddy around the reader and that you could sort of come in and out of it. So in that way, I sort of think of it as exactly what you're saying, that there's these like moments that sort of become ascendant and then it gets quieter again. And then we sort of do that on and off. Some people have called it a fragmentary novel, and that's because it does bring in a bunch of different storylines in small pieces.
I understand that, I guess, fragmentary. I think of it more personally anyway as we see the full aspect of this woman's life. It isn't focused on just the career. It isn't focused on just the library. It isn't focused on just the marriage. It's sort of a day in the life continually throughout the duration of the novel.
To me, that's how we all do live. We're living at thinking at any given time about
right.
what we're doing, how we're going to go pick up our kids or how we're going to our job. But we also might be thinking about the latest dark news we heard about climate or something that we've seen in the political arena. So I sort of wanted to figure out how there was a way to just show that slippage that I think most of us have, where one moment you're thinking of seemingly a very everyday thing and the next you're thinking of something that is on a much bigger scale.
And ultimately, what happens when that bigger scale takes over, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Part of the novel storyline is about how Lizzie, this librarian, sort of does a deep dive into the world of the climate crisis because she works answering questions for a former professor of hers who now has a podcast about it. And the part where she sort of existed in what I think of as like a twilight knowing about these things. Mm. And now she's looking at it more steadily. And for a long time in the novel, that's a hard place to be. As you get farther in, I think that she starts to see some more glimmers of how one might go forward once you tune into the magnitude of it, but you also maybe at the same time tune into what people around you are doing and how you might join into that.
Tell us a little bit about Lizzie and how you wanted her to be.
Well, I wanted her to be very porous. She's someone that people come in all the time to the library, and anyone who spent any time in a public or university library knows that librarians are wearing many, many hats these days. They're social workers as well as working in libraries. They're often helping people who've lost their job or people who may be in the throes of an addiction. So I wanted her to be someone who is very compassionate to the people around her and to her own family. And maybe that took up almost all of her energy. So when she first tries to think about things beyond that, she sort of thinks, oh, now I have to worry about the whole world, too. So I wanted it to be someone who is constantly thinking about the people around her, but doesn't necessarily have a lot of extra time where she's involved in bigger issues.
I'm hoping you can read a section of the novel, and I believe this is from the beginning.
Yes, this is from near the beginning, when she first starts working for her former mentor, Sylvia. And she's going to a lecture of Sylvia's. I'm late for the lecture now, and I was wrong about which building it's in. By the time I get there, Sylvia's almost through speaking. There's a big crowd. Behind her is a graph shaped like a hockey stick. What it means to be a good person, a moral person, is calculated differently in times of crisis than in ordinary circumstances, Sylvia says. She pulls up a slide of people having a picnic by a lake. Blue skies, green trees, white people. Suppose you go with some friends to the park to have a picnic. This act is, of course, morally neutral. But if you witness a group of children drowning in the lake and you continue to eat and chat, you have become monstrous. The moderator makes a gesture to show it is time to wrap up. A line of men is forming behind the microphone. I have both a question and a comment, they say. A young woman stands up to wait in line. How do you maintain your optimism? She asks. I can't get to her afterwards. I walked the subway, trying to think about the world. Young person worry. What if nothing I do matters? Old person worry. What if everything I do does?
Jenny Offhill reading from Weather, the new novel from Knopf. In these segments, as she is working with her mentor, when you thought of that relationship between mentor and then student, and now someone who is working for her as a part of this podcast, Helen Highwater, and answering the letters, how did you want to see that relationship or have us see that relationship?
Well, early on in the novel, Sylvia she's always been calling and checking in on Lizzie ever since she dropped out of grad school. She's always asking her, oh, are you still squandering your promise? And Lizzie always is saying, yes, yes, I am. And so this moment where she finds a way to reconnect with her, it's both something that is exciting for her. It's also a little bit of a pull back into this world of academia and research that she's walked away from. I think as someone who's taught for many years and also who had the benefit of having teachers that were really important to me, I've always been kind of fascinated by that relationship. My parents were both middle school and high school teachers, and they'd get letters years later from people that remembered their classes. And I just think there's something about that teacher relationship that can really prod you to do more things than you plan to do with your life.
There is also, in the novel, the relationship with her brother, which is so very important.
It is very important. One of the reasons that she did drop out of school instead of finishing her degree was that her brother was addicted to drugs, and she wanted to help him with his recovery. and I don't think she could figure out how to do all of it at once. As the novel opens, he's been in recovery for a while, but he's very dependent on her. And I wanted to show what it's like to have that very enmeshed kind of quality that you have with your family members, where sometimes things seem to go in circles, but you keep trying to give the care and trying to give the solace, but there's also a lot of frustration and irritation that's mixed in with that.
In the writing of the novel, we talked about how you described it, and fragmentary was one word that you used. But in the sentences, how do you work on those? Is it each burst that you hone, or is it a complete, it has to go through it completely to see how it works in relationship to the other segments?
I do work on it at sort of a sentence and paragraph level, instead of many fiction writers will write a draft and then
right.
go back to it. But for me, that's just never been the way I worked. In some ways, it takes me a while to understand what I want the story part of it to be about. And so in the meantime, I'm just trying to get the language to be as precise as it possibly can, and also to feel like the imagery and the voice of the characters is coming through strongly. So I do it in these little sections, and then I assemble them about halfway or three quarters of the way through the process. And that's when I start to feel like the trajectory of the storyline is becoming clearer to me.
What is that assembling process like? It seems daunting.
It is daunting. And it's one of the ways I think of it sometimes is, I myself am not someone who does jigsaw puzzles, but my mother-in-law loves them. And whenever she comes over, we always get a new jigsaw puzzle. And I watch her do them. And I think to myself, it's sort of the way I feel when I'm working on a novel, that I can tell when pieces fit together. I know that this fits. But the part where I'm not sure what's on the box and whether it's a picture of a beautiful forest or a bunch of kittens, it takes me a while for that part of the imagery to come through. And so in the meantime, I'm just noticing in a somewhat intuitive way when I can feel, it's basically a click kind of feeling, that these things go together and they'll stay together. I'm also a rather merciless editor of my own work. So things that don't last for a while as fitting together just get, I cut, or I move them to the end of the novel, and sort of they're in the penalty box.
I'm hoping you can read to us another segment. This is later on in the novel, and tell us where we are at this point.
So Lizzie's married, but at this point she's developed a crush on a war reporter who she's met at the bar where she used to work. And he, of course, has all sorts of skills that would work in times of disaster. Meanwhile, Lizzie herself has been kind of falling down these prepper holes where she's learned all sorts of things of dubious value that she now is talking to him about. Then one day, the guy I have a crush on comes in. His name is Will. Turns out he's some kind of journalist, recently back from Syria. He has an odd side gig, taking kids out for wilderness trips. No set line between lost and not lost, he tells me. And I write this down on a napkin. And then somehow it's four drinks later, and I'm telling him about the coming chaos. What are you afraid of? He asks me. And the answer, of course, is dentistry, humiliation, scarcity. Then he says, what are your most useful skills? People think I'm funny. I know how to tell a story in a brisk, winning way. I try not to go on too much about my discarded ambitions or how I hate hippies and the rich. But in terms of skills, he says. And I tell him, I know a few poems by heart. I recently learned how to make a long-burning candle out of a can of tuna. Oil-packed, not water. I've learned how to recognize a black walnut tree and that you can live on the inner bark of a birch tree if need be. I know it's important to carry chewing gum at all times for post-collapse morale, and also because it suppresses the appetite and you can supposedly fish with it, but only if it is a bright color and has sugar. Only then will a fish investigate and somehow get hooked to the end of the fishing pole I have fashioned with a sharpened paperclip and a string and a stick. You can last 3 hours without shelter, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food, 3 months without hope. But don't drink your own urine. That's a myth. And don't eat snow. You have to melt it first. If you have a toothache, you can put crushed aspirin on it. All you need to make toothpaste is baking soda, peppermint oil, and water. You can chew on a stick until it splinters into a toothbrush. He keeps touching my arm, this guy. Sometimes your heart runs away with someone, and all it takes is a bandana on a stick.
Jenny Offill reading from Weather, a novel published by Knopf. In the assembly process, it would seem that you would have to be very, that there would be a point where you could change the intention of the novel if that is not in the proper sequence.
Absolutely. And I think it is the danger of a novel that is put together in these sort of pieces is you don't want it to be that you could move the pieces and that would be fine with you. You want to be sure that they are in the order and that's the only order they can be in. So for me, I write short novels, but they do take me a while for that reason, because I find that the only true way to know that is really for some time to pass and for me keep going over and over it. Sometimes I do sort of strange things where I will print things out, even cut them up into little scraps and then paste them on a board so that I can sort of see it outside of my head and get a sense of what I might be missing when I'm still looking at it on the screen. Because sometimes I feel like you get used to how you've put together a story, mm-hmm. and the options of where you might go with it start to be lost to you. When I'm talking to my writing students, I call it kind of the tar pit, because you can sometimes end up somewhere and every time you try to get out, you stick yourself in again. So that's what I worry about, and that's what I'm often trying to do during the revision process.
What is the concern? If the sentence is conveying what you want it to convey, what is the concern then of the way it looks when it's on that wall?
For me, it's about juxtaposition. I like to put a lot of facts from different disciplines into my novels. I think it's because I just love to read nonfiction as well, and sometimes I find things that mm-hmm. it seems it would be fun to have in as well. And so I think what I'm doing when I'm concerned about that is I'm trying to make sure that the facts that I'm including, whether they're about polar exploration or astronomy or, in this book, disaster psychology, I want them not to be a point-by-point obvious connection. I want them to sort of come in slantwise, because if I put them in a very direct way, there's a way it can seem a little schematic, like I've decided this will show this, this will prove that. So what I do instead is I make long lists of the facts that I'm interested in, mm-hmm. and then when I'm writing the narrative, I kind of see what floats back in. Sometimes I can't find them, of course, because I'm so bad at labeling files.
Philosophy too, though, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, philosophy is a huge part of this novel, especially in the first half.
Well, there's a joke that she has about her husband where she notices that he's reading the Stoics before breakfast, and she thinks, oh, that can't be good, can it? And then later on in this breakfast scene, he seems unduly cheerful, and she realizes it must be because he is viewing the scene as if from a great height, as the Stoics advise you to do.
But even, and that is beautiful and wonderful, but also in her relationship with the people that she runs into, being a librarian.
Absolutely. There's one recurring character who is a grad student working on philosophy. And in general, I think she's really interested in that very fundamental question of philosophy, you know, how then shall we live? And all of the different people that come in with their versions of it are fascinating to her. She joins a group that is being held in the library that's a Buddhist meditation group. So she also ends up learning a lot about Buddhist philosophy as the book goes on.
Let us talk about where we are as far as what brought you to this novel at this time. It takes place basically in 2016. Is that when you started it, shortly after?
No, I was writing it for several years before that. And the time frame of the book is it probably starts in 2015. It goes through the election. And then I did something I've never done before, which is that it ends a little bit in the future. It ends after right. what will be the election in November. I was writing already about what I think of as sometimes with a novel, I start with an emotion. And in this one, I was thinking about anticipatory dread and how much when we are fearing something and we don't know the shape of it, how much worse it is. I was thinking about that in the context of climate change, but also originally in the context of just getting older and worrying about various kinds of decline. But as I dove into learning more about climate change, I think, as happens to many people when they do this, I realized how much worse the situation was than it really was when I'd last checked into it, that the models had been too conservative and that things were moving a lot faster. And I became interested in trying to figure out how to write a character who starts out not at all a denier of climate change, but just someone that isn't necessarily spending much time thinking about it. And what is it like, the process, as you learn more? She's always taken in things from the people around her, but she starts to have these little flickers of sort of interspecies moments where she's noticing birds and trees and even the fly that she lets go that she caught in her house. So that was my beginning point. When the election happened, like a lot of fiction writers, I had a dilemma because I thought if I didn't write about it at all, the book would be frozen in amber a bit.
Right.
But luckily, it also went along with my theme of dread.
Well, right. And that's what I was going to ask you, because as you begin of what dread looks like, well, now we kind of know what it
looks
like.
Now we know. And I do think that there was a really interesting period right after the election where everyone was trying to imagine what was going to happen. And some people were spinning out, it won't be as bad as you think scenarios. And some people were spinning out, it'll be much worse than you think scenarios. The latter may have been closer to the truth, but I wanted to write about what it felt like. I felt like there was kind of a hum in the air during that time. Everyone was talking about it, even those people that were very pleased with the results. I was hearing a lot of ambient kind of conversation about it. And I wanted to work that into the novel, but I also didn't want to date the novel so that only if you didn't know the details of what had happened during the presidential election, I didn't want it to be that you couldn't understand what the characters were feeling or thinking. That's why I don't name Trump in the book.
One of the things that really resonated with me, and maybe that's just because of what I do for a living, but I was struck by why people write in the first place, that there is that need from someone to help in figuring out what the future is going to be like. Is it going to be okay? Should I have children in this environment? What can happen? What will happen? And you find, as I often do on the radio, very ill-equipped to answer those questions, yet you are continually being asked them.
Well, I listen to a lot of public radio, and it's one of the things that I always think is very interesting when people call in with the questions, whether it's for a show about birds. Some of the questions are the equivalent of technical questions about birds, but some of them are, the birds don't come anymore. Right. Outside my house. Have I done something? What have I done? They're often very human questions. And I feel like one of the things I think is hard for a lot of people these days is that there isn't community in the same way that they used to experience it. We have online communities that partially fill that void, but I think that there's a lot of desire for another person to talk to you, to help you with your fears, to really just listen. And that's what, whether you're writing letters or calling into a show, that can be the role that you play. But you're absolutely right that she often doesn't know how to answer the questions that she's asked.
And you have, there's this fear and there's this dread, and the person is looking for some sort of solution to that. And as you just indicated, the person who's answering may or may not know. But as you write in this novel, we see what toll that takes on her.
I think that's true of many people in helping professions of any sort. And I would include people who work in libraries or work answering questions for shows like this, because I think generally you have to have a knack for empathy to do those jobs. But that same ability to be empathetic means that you often take in all of it, and the parts that you can't solve make you feel guilty and sad and worried about the people that you want to help but can't. So I think that as she goes farther and farther into this world, because she also receives questions that are really about conspiracy theories. She receives questions that are about where should I live? Where should my children live in 2030? She grew up in an evangelical household, so she also is well equipped to answer the rapture questions and the questions that have to do with that.
Does she know, do you think, Lizzie, do you think she knows more because of this frontline approach than Sylvia does?
I think she might. I think one of the things that is the difference between Lizzie and Sylvia is Sylvia never had children, and she's been doing this work for many years. And at one point in the book, Lizzie calls her up and Sylvia says, oh, I can't talk right now. I'm writing an article and I have to put in the obligatory note of hope. And there's a bit of a cynical turn to it, because she's talking about how, and for those of us that ever click on the environmental tab, you know what she means, which is that you'll read very terrible predictions and horrible things. And then at the very end, there'll be this sort of, it's like the swell of music that comes at the end of a movie where suddenly we're told, but everyone can work together and we'll all do it. If we all do it immediately, then everything will be just fine. And so I think that Lizzie doesn't have that cynicism, but she also has a steep learning curve of understanding what are quite complicated issues. I mean, one of the things I found when I started trying to learn about climate change is it was amazing to me that it could be both terrifying and boring at the same time. I was sort of trying to learn the science of it and learning the back and forth. And I thought, no wonder a lot of people glaze over when they're trying to enter into it, because the beginning part of entering into it is not the easiest.
After you finish the novel and you turn the very next page, it says www.obligatorynoteofhope.com.
So I did make a website that is meant to be a jumping off point. If you finish the novel and you have no interest in seeing the supplementary material, that's why it's not in there. But I did find that as I myself was researching the novel, I did come across things that made me hopeful, mostly made me hopeful about the possibility of what can be done with collective action. I also came across a lot of stories of people that had lived in really difficult periods of history. And while in the book there's lots of things, as you saw in the passage I read, about sort of material prepping. Oh, how can we make our tuna can into a light? By the end of it, I was much more interested in what I thought of as sort of emotional or spiritual prepping. So there's a section in the website, Tips for Trying Times, that is all quotes from different people. It also has stories about people who did things for their community. And then finally, it has a portal into three organizations that do collective work.
Jenny Offhill's new book is Weather. It is a novel. It is published by Knopf. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.